Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. There's plenty of room out there in the cosmos, but is it also crowded, chock full of other Earth-like planets and maybe other life? Or are we more or less alone, a speck of life in a lonely universe? A NASA telescope being launched tonight should finally answer the question of whether Earth-like planets are abundant or rare. And that, say scientists, is the key to life. This hour On Point, is there anybody out there? We'll talk about the Kepler telescope, its mission, and the ongoing search for life beyond Earth. You can join the conversation. What's your preference? Crowded with life? Us alone? Joining me first today from Los Angeles to look at the busy run of space news lately is Emily Lakdawala. She covers space exploration and space science at the Planetary Society blog. Emily, thanks very much for being here.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
All kind of headlines in the news recently about stuff going on in space and not quite making it there. Everybody heard, just a week ago or so, the morning of Tuesday, February 25th, NASA's Orbiting Carbon Observatory lifting off in California. There was so much excitement. Here's the sound of that, Emily.
T-minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Zero. And liftoff of the Taurus rocket with OCO, tracking a greenhouse gas in seek of clues to global warming.
There's the liftoff. Things don't always work protectively. It wasn't much later we heard, well, there was trouble.
This is Taurus Launch Control. We have declared a launch contingency, meaning that we did not have a successful launch tonight. The OCO spacecraft did not achieve orbit successfully.
Emily, so much excitement, high hopes, a lot of money spent. What happened?
What happened was what happens every once in a while in the space business, a launch accident. It had nothing to do with the satellite, unfortunately. It was just that the launch vehicle didn't quite work as they expected it to. Launch vehicle typically takes off. There's something called a fairing protecting the spacecraft as it goes up through the atmosphere. It makes it aerodynamic and helps it plow up through the top of the atmosphere. Once it gets out of the atmosphere, it's supposed to split away like a clamshell, and this time it just didn't.
$278 million in all those years in work and planning and hopes. Do heads roll after something like that? I mean, how could that happen?
It does happen. They do have they're appointing an investigation board to find out why it happened and, more importantly, to make sure that it doesn't happen again. But space exploration is quite risky. It's one of the riskier things we do, and accidents do happen. Fortunately, there are other spacecraft that are going to try to recover some of the science. The Japanese just launched a spacecraft that is designed to look for carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere. So we have that one, and of course NASA will be looking at trying to recover the science that Orbiting Carbon Observatory wanted to do when they launched.
Maybe some relief there. Speaking of accidents, we also had this big satellite collision that we saw in the headlines was supposedly may have filled the near-Earth orbit 500 miles up or so with all kinds of junk and debris. This was an old Soviet-era satellite and an American satellite. What's the aftermath?
Well, the aftermath is that they have to track all the pieces and figure out if they do pose a threat. There is lots of junk up there. There's thousands and thousands of pieces of space junk up there. The larger ones can actually be tracked from Earth by telescopes. Some even people with backyard telescopes are tracking an astronaut glove that's still floating around there that the space station astronauts dropped. But it's a growing problem, and there's going to have to be some more international work where countries work together to share information on the stuff that they've lost up there in space to make sure that it doesn't endanger any future spacecraft, particularly spacecraft that have humans on them.
Everybody weaving their way through that now as they get out into space. You mentioned Japan, China also in the news, a lunar probe landing on the moon or crashing into the moon. What's up with China in space these days?
China has a very aggressive space program. They're really pushing forward to get themselves onto the moon. They've just, Chang'e-1 just crashed into the moon. That was an intentional end of their first lunar orbiter. And they're talking about launching a lunar mission to do a soft landing in 2011 and actually do a lunar sample return in 2013.
So this was kind of a trial run that they deliberately crashed into the moon. Why? It was finished, so set it down?
That's right. It was finished, so set it down, clear the lunar orbit, make sure that there isn't junk up there like there is junk in Earth orbit. And also, I think it was a bit of a test of their ability to guide the spacecraft down to the surface. Even though they couldn't soft land this one, it was valuable practice for their next soft landing.
There's China coming on strong. Any signs of the Obama administration and how it looks at NASA and spending on space?
Well, early signs indicate that the Obama administration thinks that spending on science is a good idea for stimulating the economy, and the NASA budget looks pretty good in that way. So I think that signs are good for the Obama administration supporting NASA's exploration of space. But remember that NASA is not the only player. I mean, there's ESA, there's China, there's also India is up there with a lunar orbiter, and Japan has a lunar orbiter that's also going to be crashing this summer.
And then the news that a pretty big asteroid in cosmic terms came pretty close to Earth recently. What? Where? How close?
How close? Well, it was within about, I believe the number is 75,000 kilometers, which is either big or small, depending on how you look at it. In space terms, it's really close. It's quite a lot closer than the orbit of the moon, to put it in perspective. And so those kinds of near misses, they do happen all the time, but they kind of make you nervous. You know, we only found out about this asteroid 3 days before it approached Earth closely. There is a worldwide network of both professional and amateur astronomers scanning the skies. The Planetary Society actually funds some of the amateurs to do this follow-up scanning to try to follow the orbits of these asteroids and make sure that they don't pose a threat to us. And it's something that we have to be concerned about. Fortunately, asteroid impacts are one of the few major natural disasters that we could actually prevent if we had enough early warning.
But this thing zipped by early just this Monday. The size of the asteroid that leveled, 800 square miles of Siberia a century ago, that's big. How could we only know 3 days in advance? We were sort of getting the impression that we were tracking everything out there. If something was headed our way, we could even maybe send out a nuclear charge and bump it off course. 3 days is not time to do anything.
No, 3 days isn't enough time. Well, it's not enough time to send the asteroid away, but it would be enough time to, say, send a population away, which would be one thing that you could do for an asteroid of this size. This asteroid is in a size range that does pose a local threat, but it doesn't pose species-ending threat, which is the kind of stuff that we're really worried about. Those things, we've spotted all of the asteroids of a size large enough to wipe out civilization or even wipe out a large portion of civilization, and there are more and more surveys coming online that are finding smaller and smaller stuff. And the question is, what do you do when you find these objects? How do you get the warnings out? How do you figure out where the asteroid may hit if it's going to hit? And how do you get people away? The good news is that most of Earth actually is uninhabited. So like Siberia, you know, there aren't very many people there to get hit by the asteroid. In all likelihood, an asteroid was hit in the ocean. And worst is, it would cause a tidal wave, which would be bad, but you could get people out of the way if you had a warning system in place.
Still, 800 square miles, there's a lot of places on Earth you could lay down that square and have a pretty scary scenario. I guess we have to thank our lucky stars, Emily, that it took a different course.
That's true enough.
Emily Lakdawala with the Planetary Society blog. It's been great talking with you. It's a busy world out there in space. Thanks very much for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Joining us now from Orlando, Florida, on his way to Cape Canaveral and the launch of the Kepler telescope is Alan Boss. He's a member of the Kepler mission's science team and an expert on extrasolar planets and planet formation. His new book is The Crowded Universe, The Search for Living Planets. Alan Boss, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on the show.
Thanks very much for being here. This is going up to look around for planets like ours. Your opening position, as I understand it, Alan, is that you expect it will find many and that the indication in that is that life in the universe may be downright abundant.
That's exactly why I titled the book The Crowded Universe, because we already know enough from the surveys to look for planets from other stars to make a prediction to say that Earth-like planets should be incredibly common. Essentially, every solar-type star might very well have an Earth-like planet, which means when you look up at the night sky and look at sun-like stars, which a good majority of the stars you see at night are, you're actually looking out at other solar systems which might very well have life on them.
So it's supposed to go up tonight, and when would it begin to feed us the information which would say yay or nay to a crowded or a lonely universe?
Well, Kepler will be able to find planets by the transit technique, which means you look for the dimming of the star's light as a planet passes in front of it. So to the extent that Kepler is focusing on trying to find Earth-like worlds on one-year orbital periods, just like the Earth's orbital period around the Sun, it will take us a good 3 to 4 years to find three or four transits, having them occur. So we want to see several transits occur to be sure that we're actually seeing a dimming which is periodic and really is what we think it is and not some spurious signal. So that means roughly 4 years from now, something like 2013, there should be a major press conference at NASA headquarters where the PI of the mission, Bill Brookie, will tell us just exactly how many Earths are out there in our galaxy.
4 years out, but already very high anticipation. Are you worried about the fate of the environmental satellite that went up and down in the Antarctic a week ago?
That was a serious concern for our group. We had a Kepler mission science team meeting over near Cape Canaveral earlier this week on Monday of Tuesday, and we had presentations from the engineers who were watching the review of the orbiting carbon observatory fate quite closely. And we had some tense moments waiting for what the outcome would be of that. But as we closed our meeting on the first night around 6:30, our PI, Bill Brookie, said he just heard on the phone that the launch review folks had decided that we basically have no parts in common with that ill-fated Taurus rocket. We're using a different rocket, a Delta II. And so there's no reason for our rocket to have any problems. So we're go for launch.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about who's home in the universe, whether we're lonely here or it's a crowded cosmos, and what the Kepler telescope may soon tell us. People have been imagining what a crowded cosmos might be like for years, certainly ever since Star Trek. Here's Captain Kirk and Mr. Spock reading their orders from Starfleet in an episode of Star Trek.
Negotiations with the Klingon Empire on the verge of breaking down. Starfleet Command anticipates a surprise attack. We are to proceed to Organia and take whatever steps are necessary to prevent the Klingons from using it as a base.
Strategically sound. Organia is the only Class M planet in the disputed area.
Okay, there's the vision of all kinds of creatures all over the place. Kepler may tell us a lot about the possibility of life on planets the size and scale of Earth in our galaxy. And we may know in just a few years. Alan Voss has joined us from Orlando, Florida. He's a member of the Kepler mission's science team on his way down to Cape Canaveral for the launch tonight, author of The Crowded Universe, The Search for Living Planets. We're joined as well right now from London, Ontario, by Seth Shostak. He's senior astronomer at the SETI Institute, which has been searching for extraterrestrial life since 1960. His latest book is Confessions of an Alien Hunter, A Scientist's Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. Seth, thanks for being here.
It's a pleasure, Tom.
So, Kepler, going up tonight, how big a deal is this?
Well, of course it's a very big deal, and everybody will tell you that, so there's nothing surprising in such a remark. But, you know, it's something like the beginning of the 16th century when we finally had wooden ships that would allow us to chart the world. You know, you could finally make a globe with most of the pieces of land that are important on it. We're going to know after Kepler's mission what fraction of stars out there have planets and how many of them are the kinds of planets we hope to find.
Do you think we'll find none, a few, a lot of Earth-like planets? What's your expectation and why?
Well, look, it's sort of an axiom of science and astronomy in particular that there are usually a lot more small things than big things. I mean, if you went looking for life in Africa, right, you'd find some megafauna. You'd find elephants and tigers and all the things that you love to look at the zoo. But you would find a lot more of the small things, right? In fact, the smaller you looked, the more of them there'd be until you got down to bacteria, in which are, you know, an enormous number. So we expect that there are going to be a lot more small planets, and small planets are the kinds that E.T. would like to call home. So we expect them to be there, but, of course, expecting is one thing. Having the data is something else.
Alan Voss, what's your kind of pre-game analysis here? It's not even up yet, but already there's reason to think, you write, that there may be many. Take us further into that and what we know so far and why it suggests that there may be many Earth-like planets.
Well, Seth's comments are exactly on target, but there's even more information that we already know from the ground-based planet surveys, which have been going on for well over a decade now. From such surveys, we know, for example, that sun-like stars, roughly 10 to 20% of them have gas giant planets like Jupiter or Saturn. And if such planets are that commonplace, it implies that Earths are even more commonplace, because we believe that gas giants are actually much harder to make than Earth-like planets. You have to make them rather rapidly while there's still gas in the disk to make a massive planet. Whereas if you happen to try to build that planet but don't make it quite fast enough, then you end up with basically a failed core, sort of a rather large Earth-like planet. So from that point of view, we expect that at least more than 20% of Sun-like stars will have Earth-like planets. In addition, the ground-based surveys have actually begun finding what we think is the tip of the iceberg of the distribution of Earth-like planets. And this is really surprising. And just in the last year, teams have announced that they believe that roughly one-third of solar-type stars have planets which we call hot and warm super-Earths. These are planets with masses maybe 5, 10, 15 times the mass of the Sun, orbiting in closer to their star than Earth. And again, if such planets are that commonplace, it implies that the ones we're looking for, the Earths, with a little bit less mass, a little bit farther out, they should be even more prevalent than that 30% number. So we're getting up close to 100% likelihood for Earths around Sun-like stars.
Seth, we don't want to push this beyond where it should really go then. We've got Sun-like stars, that's familiar, the expectation of many Earth-like planets. How big is the leap from there to life, Seth Shostak?
If you ask me, I would say it's a reasonable leap. If you ask the biologists, I think you'd get a diversity of opinions, because just because you have a lot of real estate, of course, doesn't mean you have a lot of, if you will, condo development on it. That depends on other things. But as Alan has just said, the expectation is there are going to be lots of Earth-sized worlds and maybe Earth-like worlds. You know, keep in mind that in our own Milky Way galaxy, there might be a trillion planets. And sure, most of them are going to be pretty unattractive, but some of them will be. Now, if I give you 1,000 or 1,000,000 Earth-like worlds, the question is, what fraction of those will develop life? And then what fraction of those, of course, would develop the kind of intelligent life that we're looking for at the SETI Institute? And we don't know the answer to that, but it is true that life sprung up on the Earth very, very quickly. And that suggests, although it doesn't prove, but it does suggest that life wasn't a very difficult thing to get started.
Alan Bosch, you've said that you're optimistic that life in our galaxy will turn out to be common. Now, that may be a commonplace to you in your line of work, but to me, it's still kind of mind-blowing. Common? And what leads you to think that?
Well, as I just argued, I think that Earth-like planets are going to be ubiquitous throughout the galaxy, that roughly every Sun-like star, or very close to, will have a habitable world. So we'll have roughly a planet with something close to the mass of the Earth, with liquid water on its surface, at least during part of its orbit. And such a planet will be sitting there orbiting around its star for maybe 5, 10, 15 billion years.
Okay.
The question is, if you have this giant petri dish ready to grow life, how are you going to stop it from growing some sort of life given that long time span? That doesn't necessarily mean that every planet is going to have intelligent life of the sort that Seth and the SETI folks will be able to detect. But I think it will mean that most planets are going to have at least some sort of primeval life, some simple singular cellular creatures, much like what lived on our planet for the first 3 to 4 billion years of our existence. And the nice thing about those creatures is that we can actually detect their presence remotely, whether or not they want us to detect them or not, because we can look for signatures of their inhabitation of the planet, such as oxygen produced by photosynthesis or methane produced by methanogenic bacteria. We can actually detect that remotely, which gives us a hope for actually seeing if there is life on these worlds.
Does that mean you're expecting it will be a fairly elementary form of life on these worlds if it's there? You've talked about a living sludge. That's not exactly what Star Trek had in mind.
That's true. But, you know, even if when NASA has sent spacecraft past the Earth to get the slingshot effect to go farther out in the solar system, it's actually rather hard to detect, with a spacecraft passing over the Earth, signs of intelligent life on our planet, other than through radio waves of the sorts that SETI are looking for. On the other hand, we can detect the fact that the Earth has life by noticing that it has signatures in its atmosphere and its spectrum, which are include the possibility and probability in case of Earth of having life. So I'm being somewhat conservative here. I'm being wild-eyed by saying that there are many Earths out there, but I'm being conservative in saying that most of them probably have some sort of life which we can detect if we're willing to take the next step after Kepler and build a space telescope which can search the atmospheres of these planets for these signs of life, the so-called biomarkers.
I want to learn more about Kepler itself, but we've got a lot of listeners with questions. Let's go to Moshe in Newton, Massachusetts. Moshe, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just want to say that detecting or trying to find some life form out there makes sense, but trying to find intelligent life form doesn't make sense. And the reason is, look, we have billions of creatures on Earth, and only one human succeeded to develop wireless communication, and that only in the last 2-3 generations.
Mm-hmm.
So most likely there are some life form like, I don't know, lizard, frog, amoeba out there. But if there is some intelligent life form out there, most likely is much more smarter than us. He probably discovered wireless communication 1 million years ago, and he's richer than us. Let him find us. That makes sense to spend so much money on trying to communicate with that life form.
Moshe, let us pick it straight up. Seth Shostak, how about it? First of all, maybe it's just lizard, frog, amoeba-style life, Moshe says, but if they're out there, he's guessing, and I wonder what you think of this, that maybe they're way more intelligent than us, so let's wait.
Of course. Well, Moshe, to begin with, I want to assure you that it isn't costing very much money because it's all privately funded, and so the amount of money being spent is really rather trivial. But
is that right? $600 million for Kepler is all private?
No, Kepler is not looking for intelligent life, of course.
I see.
Kepler's just looking for But the SETI project, which, of course, is what Moshe is referring to there, is indeed privately funded. So there's not a lot of money. You don't have to worry about that. And by the way, it's not tax dollars. So never mind that. The point that Moshe is trying to make is that, yeah, Captain Kirk might go out into the galaxy and find lots of worlds with life, but it's all stupid life, right? It's lizards, the frogs or whatever, but it never gets to intelligence because, after all, he looks around, there may be 1 million species on Earth, and only one is clever enough to, build a radio transmitter, and that's true. But then again, Moshe, consider this. Several other species have gotten smarter in the last 50 million years. You know, the dolphins have gotten smarter, okay, but also octopuses, birds, obviously our primate, our simian relatives, all of them gotten smarter. At some point, one of these species crosses a threshold and gets clever enough to develop science and technology. They do that. They look around, and they say, my gosh, we're the only ones. Well, of course they're the only ones because they're the first. There's no gainsaying the fact that it may be that intelligence is a very rare phenomenon, but we don't have evidence that that's true. So I do think that many of these worlds will develop intelligence. As far as the aliens being way ahead of us, sure, they could be billions of years ahead of us, not just millions. Remember, the universe is old. Mm-hmm. But so what? They can't find us. They can't, because our radio broadcasts have only reached 50, 60, 70 light years into space. They're not that close.
Because we've only had them for a few decades, 60 years or so, as
Moshe
says.
Exactly. I Love Lucy began in 1953. What is that? 56 years ago. The 56 light years are only a couple of thousand stars within that distance. Forget that, Moshe. We've got to look for them.
Alan Boss, how do you look at the question of intelligent life and time? If it's been around for billions of years, you might expect that even if they were lazy, they might have come across us. But I don't even know how to begin to look at how those two things intersect.
I think one of the key things is to emphasize, again, the point that Seth just made, that the natural time scale for astronomy for the evolution of the universe is billions and billions of years. Right? The galaxy is something like 13.87 billion years old, plus or minus a few days. Whereas human beings have only been around as recognizable species for something like maybe 160,000 years, depending on which anthropologist you talk to.
Mm-hmm.
We've only had technologically developed life for a few hundred years. How much longer will we be willing and wondering about our neighbors? Certainly for the next couple hundred years, we're going to be still developing science. But, maybe a couple thousand years from now, we'll probably have everything pretty much figured out from the point of view of science. That's still, a pretty small time scale compared to these billions of years. We could simply be out of phase with many other civilizations. Other civilizations may have had their – remember, our Earth only formed roughly 4.5 billion years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps other folks living on planets that formed more like 10 billion years ago, they are 5 billion years out of phase with us. And the same thing for planets which are still forming right now. We look in star-forming regions. There are new stars, new planetary systems forming right now. They've got perhaps 5 billion years before they have intelligent life forming if they follow the Earth terrestrial model. So it could simply be a question of phasing. But I also would say it could also be a question of boredom. If you keep looking and after a while you say, well, we know life is out there. We've seen evidence for other planets. Maybe if they'll send us a radio signal, maybe not. Maybe we're tired of listening to their radio waves. Who knows?
Is there any reason to speculate that intelligent life in different parts of the galaxy might emerge in a similar time frame, that maybe intelligent life all over has a comparable and shorter lifespan than the billions of years since the creation.
I think that's a good case, and that's, of course, why the SETI search is undergoing right now. We do think there's a, you know, within the time span of the light travel time difference, of course, there is a good chance at least some intelligent civilizations are functioning right now, and that's the motivation in the end for the SETI search that's undergoing right now.
Seth Shostak, how and why might we think that other intelligent life would be on our in our same sort of time frame as opposed to, you know, having peaked a billion years ago, let's say?
Well, you make a good point. I mean, obviously, we're here now in a couple of hundred years of technology compared to the 4.5 billion year existence of the Earth, or for that matter, the 13 billion year existence of the universe. That's small. But on the other hand, if you're routinely making new societies, new technological societies, and maybe they only last for a few thousand years or 10,000 years, 100,000 years, who knows what our future is, there would still be some guys that are around now. It's sort of like, you know, termites don't have a very long lifespan, and yet there are termites out the door right here, right? And mm-hmm. And that's only because they keep renewing them, so they're always new termites, okay? So even though the lifetime of an individual society might not be very long in the cosmic sense, as long as you're producing new ones at a reasonable rate, then you can say we've got some cosmic company now, and there might be signals going through our bodies as we sit here, right, that would tell us mm-hmm. that somebody is out there.
Let's go to Pete in Westfield, Massachusetts. Pete, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Good. What do you know?
Well, I'd actually just like to start by saying that, well, Seth Shostak, also I'm a big fan of the podcast. Look forward to it every week.
This is Seth's show, Are We Alone? SETI's weekly radio program, yeah.
Yep. I think that more people should embrace this big picture kind of philosophy. You know, pardon me, I'm out of breath, I just ran from my car. this Saganite philosophy, we're really just a pale blue dot in the universe. It's unfathomably large. I think we need to support more programs like SETI and science education, because it really, I mean, we just spent the last hour talking about all the diplomatic and, you know, social problems that we're having that makes them seem really very insignificant in the long run. You know, we're really all just earthlings.
Pete, we got it. We're coming up to a break. Catch your breath in the Earth atmosphere. We know how hard it can be. Easier to bounce on the moon, we hear. But thank you for calling. Alan Boss, we saw the project manager here on Kepler, Fanson, Dr. Fanson, saying that he hopes the answer is yes about other Earths out there. He says, I hope the universe is teeming with planets like Earth. Does that idea bring you comfort, Alan Boss? Is it, as for Pete, somehow settling, calming to know, encouraging?
Yeah, I think that's the expectation of most scientists, is that, yes, Earth should be quite commonplace. I think few people believe in a completely anthropocentric universe where we are unique. I think it does make a sense that the laws of physics and chemistry apply everywhere throughout our galaxy, as well as the other galaxies in the observable universe. And therefore, if we can find life on our planet in its wonderful diversity, why not have life everywhere? It's sort of a pantheistic view, as you would, of the universe, that we should not be unique. There should be life everywhere, and therefore everything is fine.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Pulsar sound behind us. Pulsars are rapidly rotating high-density stars that emit regular pulses of radiation. These are radio waves we're hearing from 2,500 light-years away, collected by radio telescopes and translated into sound waves. We're talking today about the Kepler telescope going up tonight out of Cape Canaveral. It's looking for Earth-like planets in the galaxy. May tell us a lot about who's home out there just how far and where such planets may be. A big indicator in the existence of such planets of the possibility of Life. Alan Boss joins us. He's a member of the Kepler mission's science team, an expert on extrasolar planets and planet formation, author of the new book, The Crowded Universe. Seth Shostak is here from the SETI Institute, joins us today from London, Ontario. He's author of Confessions of an Alien Hunter, A Scientist's Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. Let's get a call from Mike in Beaufort, North Carolina. Mike, you're on the air.
Hi. So I want to just say that I love science. I love Chandra, Hubble, and I look forward to finding out what Kepler finds. And I even love the fact that SETI's out there. But let me make one comment and then a question. The comment is, why is it so antiquated and conservative to think that it's possible that life is a unique phenomenon here? We barely know what life is. We barely know how to explain exactly how to first some chemical reactions. I think if it turned out that life was unique to Earth and all of this massive universe with all these Earth-like things, the implications would be as staggering as that there might be life out there. But having said that, and said that I support the mission fully, what I'd like to know is, if you find in 3 or 5 years all these wobbles, which just say there are objects out there, given the difficulty we've had about answering these questions about Mars, which is right next door, what is the next step and how long from now would it be to doing anything to establish possibility of life on these things that are incredibly further away than Mars next door?
Mike, you've got great and large questions. Let me sort of begin to wade into them. First with you, Alan, on the technical question. Mike raises the wobbles. You might explain to us what he's talking about there and maybe give us some more detail on where Kepler is aimed, exactly how it's going to determine if there are Earth-like planets out there, and then to his question of, even if they do show up, what kind of onward horizon of exploration or interaction does that suggest? Hundreds of years? Decades? Thousands of years? But take us from the start with the technology, how this works and where it's aimed.
Sure. Of the roughly 330 or so planets found so far, roughly 300 of them have been found by looking for the wobble of the star around the center of mass of the star-planet system. And that wobble is primarily detected by looking for the Doppler shift of the motion of the star around the center of mass.
And there's a tiny wobble in the star because of the gravitational pull of the little planet orbiting?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yes. The Sun orbits around the center of mass of the solar system roughly every 12 years. Basically, Jupiter is the other big object which makes the Sun wobble around. So every 12 years, the Sun wobbles around an orbit which is roughly equal to its own diameter and size, and it moves around that orbit with a speed of about 30 miles per hour.
So Kepler's going beyond looking for wobbles to actually looking for the mark of the planets themselves.
Right. Kepler is not using that technique to find planets. He's using the so-called transit photometry method, where you watch for the planet which has an orbit inclined such that it passes in front of the star. Mm-hmm. Watch for the planet to dim the star's light as it passes in front of it. So it's a rather painstaking effort. You have to watch a star for an Earth-like planet and wait a year in between the very tiny dimmings produced by having the Earth-like planet pass in front of the star and dim its lights.
Cool.
So it's a rather long-term project. It's not quite as rapid as the wobbled technique, but it's the only way we know of right now to find for sure Earths around sun-like stars.
And how was it decided where to aim Kepler? You're not looking all over the place. You're looking in a particular area.
That's right. Kepler will be staring at a field of stars in the constellations of Cygnus and Lyra in the northern hemisphere, and staring at roughly 100,000 to 170,000 stars continuously for at least 3.5 years. And that particular field was chosen because you wanted to have a rich field with lots of stars, but not so rich that the stars all blend themselves together. So, for example, if you had pointed closer to the galactic plane, you would have even more stars on your field of view, but the stars would be blended together. You wouldn't be able to separate one star out from the other. If you pointed towards the galactic pole, the stars would be well separated, but there would not be very many stars on your field of view. So Kepler took the happy medium in between, found a region of space where there are lots of stars, well resolved, so you can actually watch them individually and see which ones are dimming when the planet passes in front of them.
Now, what kind of numbers would seem reasonable to you to expect for findings in this area? If we know of 300 and some already, I mean, we won't hold you to this, but what kind of numbers? And what about the question raised here? Let's say there are Earth-like planets out there. Let's say we find a whole bunch more of them. What next? What then?
Well, the estimate is that Kepler should find probably hundreds of so-called hot Jupiters, gas giant planets closer to their star than even the Earth is. and probably dozens, if not 100 or so, Earth-like planets. If Earth-like planets are as frequent as we believe they are based on what's already been discovered, then Kepler will literally find dozens and dozens of Earths. And once that that discovery is made and we know exactly what the fraction is of Sun-like stars having Earth-like planets, maybe 10%, maybe it's 20%, maybe it's 90%, which is sort of what I've been arguing. Once that determination is made, then NASA and the European Space Agency and any other international body which would like to be part of the search will know how best to design the next space telescope to actually be able to take a picture of a nearby Earth and learn something about its atmosphere and see if perhaps there are biomarkers in the atmosphere which could tell us about that planet possibly being not only inhabitable but even inhabited.
And what about the time frame of interaction? If there were life there, if that were ever to happen, are we talking, is that, you know, eons from now, or might we know and then just have thousands of years to sit here and think about it?
That is part of the problem, of course, because we don't really know how to exceed the speed of light or even come close to it with macroscopic objects. So for some time in the future, our only way of interacting with other planets and other worlds which have life will be through examining them remotely by remote sensing, looking at the radiation that comes from the planets, their reflected light, their infrared light, which is emitted by the planet, and using those signals from the electromagnetic spectrum to tell us something about what life is like on the planet. If we actually find a nearby Earth-like planet, which seems to have life, which I think is going to be the case, we'll probably just want to build larger and larger space telescopes to get a better and better picture of what that planet might look like. For example, we might be able to actually get a few pixels of resolution on the planet and tell whether or not it has oceans and continents and cloud caps and ice caps and things. We'd like to send a spacecraft there, but that is rather hard to do. It might very well take tens of thousands of years to send a spacecraft there and then have the video picture come back to us at the speed of light. So if we do send such a spacecraft out, we'd have to tell people to remember to wait for 10,000 years for that signal to come back. You know, wait for that email message to come back and get that JPEG image, and hopefully when you click on the JPEG, you won't get a virus in it.
Is there any way to confirm life via telescope? You know, a chance of seeing the little Martian giving the peace sign back, or do you actually have to set foot on the planet, or some robot at least, to do that?
I think the best way to confirm intelligent life would be through the SETI search. That is the way. We'd have to find a signal coming from either electromagnetic radiation of some sort, either radio waves, maybe even optical pulses. Folks also think that people could be shining lasers at us and blinking them periodically. That's the only way I know of finding true proof of at least intelligent life, other than sending a spacecraft there, which because of the speed of light, it is pretty prohibitively slow.
Seth Shostak, what about it? Once Kepler's findings come back, if they're along these lines and we're talking, I don't know, maybe 100 Earths discovered, does it change the way SETI listens to the cosmos? I mean, you essentially listen. Will this change, you know, sort of where you bend your ear or change what you do?
Well, of course. I mean, it would be like looking for life in the desert. If you found a few oases, you probably would concentrate your searches there.
Mm-hmm.
And so if Kepler, as expected, does find, you know, 50, 30, 100, whatever, Earth-like worlds, then of course we will aim our antennas in their direction, hoping to pick up something. Now mind you, that sounds very encouraging. I don't want to overstress how happy we would be about that, because keep in mind that if you pointed an antenna at the Earth for most of its 4.5 billion years of existence, you wouldn't have heard anything.
Right.
The dinosaurs were very coy. They were very quiet, and not to mention the trilobites, which I won't. Because, so, in fact, only for...
Radio silence.
Yeah, radio silence. So you really need a very, very long list. But the important point is this, not so much that, doggone, we get another couple of dozen really good targets in the sky to listen from, but that we know that there are, you know, how many targets there really are in the sky. That's the important thing to know, whether Earth-like worlds are rare or otherwise. I did want to come back just very briefly to what Mike said.
Yes,
because
please.
He pointed out that we really don't have any evidence yet of any life beyond Earth. But, Mike, I'll bet you a cup of coffee we're going to change that answer in the next 10 to 20 years, because either we're going to find life on Mars, or Alan and the team are going to find spectroscopic evidence, that is, evidence in the atmospheres of very distant planets that they have methane or oxygen or something that would betray life, or SETI is going to pick up a signal from ET asking us to buy their used cars or join their book club or whatever it is. One way or the other, I think in the next 10 to 20 years, you're going to pick up a big headline on the front porch.
10 to 20 years to essentially know or have a much clearer signal whether or not we're alone.
whether there's life beyond Earth, whether life is a miracle limited to this planet, or whether life is just an infection you find all over the place.
10 to 20 years, that's a period of time that we can grasp. Ariel's calling from Dorchester, Massachusetts. Ariel, you're on the air.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
Great topic, and I appreciate the diversity of topics on the show.
Thank you.
Enjoy it. I guess my point is, in answer to a response to your question about whether we would, you know, like there to be more planets out there with Earth, that are Earth-like or not, for me, it's okay either way. I think my concern is, what are we going to do with the information? It's good to know, but then once you know, what kind of decisions are going to be made? Because I guess my argument is that one could argue we haven't done such a great job as of managing our own planet and our own species. And
I'm
concerned to hear about space junk out in the Earth's orbit now that we're not only polluting our own atmosphere, but it's extending beyond that. And I'm just wondering, if we were to make some kind of contact or detect through these telescopic images intelligent life on other planets, how could we potentially use that information to try to solve some of our own problems, like global warming, like...
The list is long, but we've got the idea, Ariel. Thank you for your call. Let us pick it up. Alan Boss, how do you come at that? I mean, what do we, if we learn something here, either of abundance or the lack of abundance, where it's crowded or we're lonely, what do we do with that knowledge? What are the implications? Practically, philosophically, how does it come home for us, for you?
Well, let me start with the practical response. The first is, if we know how frequently Earth-like planets are, that will tell NASA and ESA how best to design the next space telescope to go back and follow up and look around nearby stars to see if we can take a picture of an Earth-like planet and learn and study its spectrum. For example, if Earths are quite common so that we think that there are maybe the 10 closest stars have 10 Earths, then we can probably build an optical chronograph telescope, which will have enough resolving power to separate those planets' light from their stars' light and tell us something about those worlds. However, if maybe Earths are a little bit less common, maybe only 10% of stars or 1% of stars, then we'll probably want to build a large infrared interferometer, which has enough resolving power to go much farther out and search for those Earths. So those are very practical reasons. They tell us and they inform us on how to continue the search for other worlds. In a more philosophical sense, I think if we find evidence for nearby Earth-like planets, which as far as we can tell are sort of in their earliest phases of life, that they have methanogenic bacteria and archaea-like objects living on them, much like our Earth was like for the first 3 to 4 billion years, then that gives us the feeling that, wow, we're living in a nursery, as it were, of planets in the galaxy where other life forms are beginning to evolve, and gives you a feeling for the continuity of life on a galactic scale, if not an Earth-like scale. On the other side, if we happen to find, for example, evidence of a nearby world, which happens to have, even though it's seemingly in the habitable zone, seems to have a lot, way too much carbon dioxide in its atmosphere than you might expect. Perhaps it has evidence for chlorofluorohydrocarbons and for ozone holes and sort of some of the horror stories that we associate with climate change on Earth. And that planet is not sending us any radio signals. Maybe that tells us, wow, we should be a little bit more careful with our own planet, because here's a nearby world which perhaps had life not too terribly long ago and things went wrong.
Seth Shostak, you hear Ariel says, well, it's okay either way with her. Find life or don't find it. Earth-like planets or not. How do you expect the information one way or another, the headline you expect within 10 to 20 years, would affect the outlook of humans on their own lives, on the cosmos?
Well, there's been a lot of thought given to that, Tom, actually. And nobody really knows the answer, because the way people normally look at this is they say, well, are there any historical analogs? Can we look back in history and see some event that's comparable, and then maybe we can learn something about how we would react?
Well, you raise wooden ships in the New World and Columbus or Leif Erikson coming home.
That changed things, but on the other hand, we could go to the New World. If we get a signal coming from some intelligent species, clearly they're going to be way ahead of us, right? Because you're not going to hear from the Neanderthals of E.T.'s world. You're only going to hear the ones that are at least at our level, and most likely they'll be way ahead of our level. So if you can understand what they're saying, and that's a very big if, but if you can understand what they're saying, then, okay, you have information coming from a society that's way beyond ours, and maybe they can tell us how to solve such problems as, you know, destruction of the environment or nuclear war, or all these things. They can tell us certainly all of physics and astronomy, and that might be useful. But on the other hand, would this change us if we didn't understand it? And I think the answer to that is yes, but I don't think people would wake up one morning, pick up the papers, and say, my God, they found a signal coming from a star system 800 light years away. That's it, Marge. I'm not going to work today. I'm just going to riot in the streets.
Right.
Not a chance. Keep in mind, 30%, 40% of Americans believe that the aliens are not only out there, but they're here buzzing the countryside and occasionally abducting them for unauthorized experiments, and they're not rioting in the streets about that.
Not yet. And if it's just a bucket of living sludge, still it means, Alan, we're not alone.
Indeed, it does. It's pretty exciting. One would hope that perhaps if we manage to get that message from a 800-year-away intelligent civilization, if they tell us what the secret is of life, maybe as simple as, you know, vote Democratic.
Or Republican, who knows? It takes a long view of time and space to keep up with you guys, but it's absolutely fascinating to try and do it, and we're very grateful for your tour of the horizon today. Alan Voss, good luck with the mission and the takeoff tonight at Cape Canaveral. Thank you so much for being with us. Thanks for your new book, The Crowded Universe.
Thank you very much, Tom.
And Seth Shostak at the SETI Institute, author of Confessions of an Alien Hunter. Wonderful to have you, Seth. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure, Tom.
We'll go out with the Carpenters, calling occupants of interplanetary craft. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.